You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English, and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 232 by Rudolf Steiner, 14 lectures entitled Mystery Knowledge and Mystery Centers. The revised translation is by Pauline Verla. This is Lecture 3, entitled A Path into the Inner Core of Nature Through Thinking and the Will. Yesterday I was speaking to you of how human beings are subject to what natural science generally calls heredity, and also of how they are subject to the influences of the external world and adaptation to it. I also said that everything relating to heredity is connected with the Ahrimanic forces, and adaptation in the widest sense with the Luciferic forces. But I also told you how in the realm of the spiritual beings that form the basis of the cosmos, provision has been made to enable the Luciferic and Ahrimanic forces to play a lawful part in human life. Something shall now be added to what was said yesterday, so we shall recall the content once again. We turned our minds to how memory and everything related to it gives human beings their configuration as soul beings. To a far greater extent than we imagine, our configuration as beings of soul originates from our memories. Our soul has been shaped by the process whereby our experiences have become memories. We are the product of our life of memory to a greater extent than we think. And anyone who is capable of exercising even enough self-observation to enable him to penetrate into his store of memories will realize how particularly important a part is played throughout earthly life by the impressions of childhood. The kind of life we spent in childhood, which really does not loom large in our consciousness, the period in which we learned to speak, to walk, and in which we got our first inherited teeth, the impressions made on us during these periods of development, all these play an important part in the life of soul throughout our life on earth. And some of what arises in us as thoughts, which have a characterological emphasis and are connected with memories, in fact, everything that does not happen to come into our thoughts by way of outer impressions has, of course, to do with memories. Things arising in this way and bringing us a gentle touch of joy or sadness, all this life of memory also accompanies our astral body when we pass into the state of sleep. If with imaginative vision we are able to observe the human being as a being of soul and spirit during sleep, the following picture presents itself. During sleep, the etheric body and the physical body are still enclosed within the skin, and the astral body is outside. I will speak of the ego later on. This astral body is seen virtually to consist of the person's memories. However, these memories in the astral body, which is now outside the physical body, are seen to be swirling in and through one another in a kind of eddy. Experiences that were widely separated in time and space are now in juxtaposition. Parts of the content of certain experiences are eliminated, so that the whole life of memory is transformed during sleep. And when a person dreams, he is becoming conscious of this transformed life of memory. And in the character and makeup of the dream, he can be inwardly aware of the swirling eddy of memories, which imaginative clairvoyance can perceive from outside. But there is another aspect as well. These memories, which from the time of going to sleep until waking form the main content of the life of the human soul, unite during sleep with the forces behind the phenomena of nature. It may therefore be said that all that lives as astral body in our memories enters into connection with the forces that lie behind, or rather, lie within the minerals, within the plants, behind the clouds, and so on. Those who recognize this truth find it horrifying when people come and say that material atoms are behind the phenomena of nature. The fact is that our memories do not unite with material atoms during sleep, but with the spiritual forces behind the phenomena of nature. This is where our memories reside during sleep, so that we can truly say that during sleep our soul dips down with its memories into the inner being of nature. And we are not saying anything untrue or unreal when we assert that when we go to sleep, we give our memories over to the powers that are spiritually active in the crystal, the plants, and all the phenomena of nature. You may go for a walk where you see by the wayside yellow and blue flowers, green grass, gleaming ears of corn promising well for the harvest. And you say to them, quote, "When I pass by you during the day, I see you from outside, but while I am asleep, I shall sink my memories into the spiritual core of your being. While I sleep, you receive and harbor the memories into which I have transformed the experiences I had in life." Close quote. There is perhaps no more beautiful feeling for nature than to have not merely an external relation to a rosebush, but to realize that you love it because a rosebush harbors the first memories of childhood. Space plays no part at all. However far away the rose bush may be, during sleep we find the way to it. The reason why people love roses, only they do not know it, is that roses receive and harbor the very first memories of childhood. When we were children, the love shown us by other human beings made us happy. We may have forgotten all about it, but we carry it in our feeling life. And when we are asleep at night, the rosebush receives into its own inner being the memory we have ourselves forgotten. We are more closely united than we realize with the world of outer nature, that is, with the spirit which presides there. Memory of our earliest childhood is particularly remarkable in connection with sleep, because in the first years of life, and in the years up to the time of the change of teeth, up to about the seventh year, it is only the element of soul that is received and harbored during sleep. It is a fact of our life as human beings that the inner spiritual core of nature harbors the element of soul belonging to our childhood. Other things can also happen. The element of soul developed in childhood, when, for example, we may have been cruel, that too remains in us. The thistles harbor it. All this is said by way of comparison, but it points to a significant reality. The following will make it clear what it is that is not received from childhood into the innermost core of nature. In the first 7 years of life, the child's whole bodily makeup is inherited, including, therefore, the first teeth. All the material substance we have in us during this period is, in essence, inherited. But after approximately 7 years, all the material substance has been thrust out and renewed. The form of the human being remains, his spirit form. His material components are gradually pushed out. And after 7 or 8 years, everything that was previously there has gone. And so, when we have reached the age of 9, our whole bodily makeup has been renewed. We then shape it in accordance with external impressions. It is very important indeed that in the early phases of life the child should be in a position to build his new body, not the inherited body, but the one developed from within himself, in accordance with good impressions from the environment and by a healthy process of adaptation. Whereas the body the child has when he comes into the world depends on whether the inherited forces are given him in a good or not so good a way, the body he has between the 7th and the 14th year is very dependent indeed on the impressions he receives from his environment. Every 7 years, we build up our body anew. Now we must realize that it is the I, the ego, that is responsible for this. Even though in a 7-year-old child the ego has not yet been born into the outer world, for it is born at a later age, nevertheless, it is at work. for it is connected, of course, with the body, and is responsible for its formation. It is the ego which forms the things I have been speaking about. All that comes to manifestation in the way of physiognomy and gesture, as the outer material expression of the human soul and spirit. It is a fact that someone who takes an active part in affairs of the world, who has many interests and assimilates their substance and content, will reveal this in his gestures and his very facial expression. In the later life of such a person, every wrinkle on his face will be indicative of his inner activity, and it will be possible to read a great deal there, because the ego comes to expression in human gesture and physiognomy. A person whose attitude to the world is one of boredom and lack of interest will retain the same facial expression all his life. Subtler experiences leave no impression on physiognomy and gestures. In many a face you can read a whole biography. In others there is not much more to read than that the individual was once a child, which does not tell you a great deal. It is extremely significant that through the change of bodily substance after every 7 or 8 years, a human being shapes his outer appearance from out of his own inner form. And this work on his outer appearance, as revealed in physiognomy and gesture, is again something that is carried, while he sleeps, into the innermost being of nature. If, then, you look at the human being with imaginative clairvoyance, and observe the ego when it is outside in the sleeping condition, you will find that the ego actually consists of physiognomy and gesture. Thus, those human beings who are able to put a great deal of their inner nature into their facial expression or their gestures have shining, radiant egos. This activity of shaping gesture and physiognomy again unites with certain forces in nature. If in life we often had the opportunity to be friendly and kind, nature is inclined, once this kindness has become a facial expression, to receive it into its own essential being. Nature takes our memories into its forces, our gestures into its very being. Human beings are so intimately connected with external nature that there is immense significance for the latter in the memories they experience in their souls, and also in the way they express their inner life of soul in physiognomy and gesture. For these live on in the innermost being of nature. As you know, I have often quoted in the abstract words of Goethe, which were really a criticism of a saying by Haller, quote, "Into the inner core of nature no earthly creature can go. Happiness enough is yours, that she her outer trappings doth show." Close quote. Goethe retorted, quote, "O you Philistine, we are within her being wherever we look. Nothing is only inside or outside, for what is inside is outside, and what is outside is inside. Ask yourself, first of all, whether you are core or shell." Close quote. Goethe said he had heard the remark in the 60s and had secretly cursed about it. He felt, naturally, he could not then know anything of spiritual science, that if someone whom he could only regard as a Philistine says, quote, "Into the inner core of nature no earthly creature can go," close quote, he shows he knows nothing of the fact that human beings, simply because they are beings with a memory, beings with physiognomy and gestures, continually penetrate into the inner being of nature. We are not creatures who stand at nature's door and knock in vain. Through our own core of being, we are connected by intimate ties with the innermost essence of nature. But because a child, until its 7th year, has a body that is wholly inherited, nothing of its ego, nothing of its physiognomy and gestures, passes over into nature. It is only at the time of the change of teeth that this begins to happen. Therefore, it is only then, after the change of teeth, that we are mature enough to begin to reflect about any natural phenomenon. Until that time, it is only arbitrary thoughts that arise in a child, thoughts that really have not very much to do with nature, and for that very reason are so full of charm. The best way to approach children is to be poetical and call the stars the eyes of heaven, and so on, and the things we speak about with children should be as remote as possible from outer physical reality. It is only after the change of teeth that children gradually grow into nature, and then their thoughts can, in course of time, comprehend thoughts of nature. Fundamentally speaking, life from the 7th to the 14th year is a period during which children grow into nature. For in this period, in addition to their memories, they also carry into the realm of nature their gestures and physiognomy. And this, then, continues throughout the whole of life. It is not until the change of teeth that, as far as the inner core of nature is concerned, we are born as separate human individuals. This is why the beings I have called elementals, the gnomes and undines, listen so eagerly when a person tells them something about childhood as it was before the age of 7. For, as far as these nature beings are concerned, human beings are really only born at the change of teeth. This is an extremely interesting phenomenon. Before that time, human beings are to the gnomes and undines beings, quote, in the beyond, close quote. Therefore, it is for them something of an enigma that human beings should appear at this age in a certain state of completion. It would, however, be immensely stimulating for pedagogical imagination if, through absorbing spiritual knowledge, a human being could really participate in a dialogue with the nature spirits. If he could transport himself into the soul of the nature spirits in order to obtain their views about what he can tell them about children. This would produce the most wonderful fairy tale imagination. And if, in olden times, fairy tales were so wonderfully vivid and full of content, it was because the storytellers could actually converse with gnomes and undines and not merely hear something from them. These nature spirits are sometimes very egoistic. They become taciturn if they are not told things they are curious to know. Their favorite stories are those about the things babies do. Then one learns a great many things from them that can create the atmosphere of a fairy tale. What seems utterly fantastic to people today can be very important for the practical application of spiritual life. It is an actual fact that, because of the circumstances I have told you about, these dialogues with the nature spirits can be extremely instructive for both sides. On the other hand, what I have said will, of course, give rise to a certain anxiety. For during sleep, human beings are continually creating images of their inmost being. Behind the phenomena of nature, behind the flowers of the field, and extending into the etheric world, there are reproductions of our memories, good and futile alike. The earth teems with what lives in human souls. Human life is intimately connected with such things. First of all, then, we encounter nature spirits as beings into whom we penetrate through our gestures. But we also find the world of the Angeloi, Archangeloi, and Archai. We grow our way into those beings too. Our memories carry us into the deeds of the angelic world, our physiognomy and gestures, for which we ourselves are responsible, carry us into the very substantiality of those beings themselves. The following sketch will give some indication of what happens when during sleep we penetrate into nature. Let this lowest curve represent our skin. As we move outward in a radial direction, we pass from the region of the Angeloi into those of the Archangeloi and the Archai. We enter the sphere of the third hierarchy, and when, during sleep, we sink down with our memories and gestures into the glowing sea of Angeloi, Archangeloi, and Archai, then, from one side, there comes another stream of spiritual beings. This is the second hierarchy, Exousia, Curiotities, and Dynamis. If we want to find something in the physical world that bears a resemblance to this, we can say that the daily course of the sun from east to west expresses the path on which the second hierarchy cross the third hierarchy. The third hierarchy hover up and down, handing to one another the golden vessels, in quotes. In this description, we think of the second hierarchy following the path taken by the sun from east to west, not the apparent but the actual daily path of the sun, for the Copernican theory does not hold good here. So if a human being has the necessary vision, he sees how during sleep he passes into the world of the third hierarchy. But this world of the third hierarchy is permeated ceaselessly by the grace of the second hierarchy flowing in from the side. And this second hierarchy also make their influence felt in our life of soul. In the lecture the day before yesterday, I pointed out to you the significance of vividly reliving experiences of youth. You may be deeply impressed if you turn again to the mystery plays, and now perhaps with greater understanding than before, read the passages about the appearance of the spirit of Johannes's youth. It is doubtless the case that a person's own inner being can become vividly perceptible to him if with an active effort of will he relives his younger days. I suggested you might pick up old schoolbooks and steep yourself in what you either learned or failed to learn from them. It does not matter whether you learned anything or not. What matters is that you should relive what happened at the time. It was vitally important for me a year or two ago, when I needed to strengthen my powers of spiritual understanding, to relive a situation of my youth. I was 11 years old at the time and had just been given a new schoolbook. The first thing that happened was that through carelessness I accidentally upset the inkpot and blotted 2 pages of the book so badly that they were illegible. That was also an action. And many years ago I relived this action many times. The textbook with the ruined pages and what I had to suffer in consequence, for the book had to be replaced by a family with very little money. I suffered dreadfully on account of this book with its enormous inkblot. As I said, it is not a matter of having behaved well in circumstances recalled in later years, but of experiencing them with real intensity. If you can recall such happenings as vividly as you possibly can, you will experience something else as well. While you are in bed, shut off from the day's impressions, you will experience a situation more than in a dream, in actual perception, in fact. If during the day you have vividly recalled a scene once inwardly experienced, then when everything around you is dark and you are all by yourself at night, you will see, as though displayed in space, a scene in which you once participated. Suppose you have recalled a scene where you were once present, say at 11 o'clock. Afterward you went somewhere else and found yourself sitting among a number of people. You have now summoned up something you experienced inwardly. What was around you outwardly at that time was entirely a spatial spectacle. If attention is paid to circumstances such as these, very significant discoveries can be made. Let us suppose that as a youngster of 17 you were accustomed to having your midday meal in a guest house where the guests were continually coming and going. Now, you recall some such scene which you had inwardly experienced, and you recall it vividly. Then in the night you have this experience. You are sitting at table with other people whom you did not see very often, because the guests in a guest house are perpetually changing. The face of one of these people makes you realize, this is something I actually lived through all those years ago. The external spatial element is added to the inner soul experience when you activate memories in this way. This means you are actually living in the stream that flows from east to west. More and more the feeling grows in you that becoming absorbed by the spiritual element into which you pass in sleep is not the only thing that happens to you, but that in this spiritual element something more is happening that is reflected outwardly in the moment when you again see the people sitting around the table in the guest house. You had forgotten about the episode, yet it is there. You see it as things can often be seen inscribed in the Akashic record. The moment you have this before you, you have made contact with the stream that flows from east to west, the stream of the second hierarchy. In this stream of the second hierarchy lives something of which the day is an image. Now, the day varies in length throughout the year. It gets longer in spring and shorter in autumn. It is longest in summer and shortest in winter. During the course of the year, the day undergoes a metamorphosis. This is caused by a stream running from west to east, countering the east-west stream. It is the stream of the first hierarchy, of the seraphim, cherubim, and thrones. Thus, if you follow how the day changes in the course of the year, if you pass from the day to the year, then, my dear friends, you pass into the stream flowing in the opposite direction, and which meets you in sleep. It is really the case that in sleep we grow into the spiritual world in a radial direction, both in the direction going from west to east and the direction going from east to west. As I have told you, when we recall some experience, vividly spatial images appear before us. It is the same when we become conscious of our will. It is just this that becomes gesture and physiognomy, when we become conscious of our will. What I am now going to say will have a certain significance for eurythmists, although naturally it is not the purpose of eurythmy to vindicate what I am saying. It is a fact that when a person really begins to shape his external appearance according to his inner being, and his ego comes more and more to expression in his physiognomy and gestures, then he does not only have an impression of the day. An impression of the day comes from passing over from a vivid inner experience of memory to a perception of things in the external world of space. To experience again what you learned at the age of 17, and then to see the people who sat at table with you in the guest house, in pictures, as in the Akashic Record, that is experiencing the day. But you can also experience the year. This is possible if we pay attention to how the will works in us. If we notice that it is comparatively easy to assert our will when we are warm, whereas it is difficult to get the will to stream through our body when we are very cold. Whoever can inwardly experience a connection between the will and being warm or cold will gradually acquire the ability to speak of a winter will and a summer will in themselves. We find that the best way to describe this will is to relate it to the seasons. Let us observe, for example, the kind of will that seems to carry our thoughts out into the cosmos and make it easy to handle the body, so that in its whole bearing and gestures, the thoughts seem to be borne out into the cosmos. They just slip out of your fingertips. You are very aware of how easy it is to activate the will. We may be standing by a tree, and something at the top of it pleases our eye, EYE. If our will is warm within us, our thoughts are carried up to the top of the tree. In fact, sometimes they even go up to the very stars in heaven, when on summer nights we feel ourselves in possession of a warm will. On the other hand, if the will within us grows cold, it is as though all our thoughts were only in our heads, and none of them could reach into our arms or legs. Everything goes into the head. The head suffers the coldness of the will, and if the coldness of the will is not so overwhelming as to give rise to a feeling of iciness, the head will become warm as a result of its own inner reaction, and then it develops thoughts. Thus we can say that summer will leads us out into the wide expanses of the cosmos. Summer will, warm will, carries our thoughts here, there, and everywhere. Winter will carries thoughts into our head. You can distinguish the two kinds of will, and we will feel that the will that carries us out into the cosmos is related to the course of the summer, and the will that carries thoughts into the head to the winter. In the same way as we experience day, we now, through the will, experience the year. You know, there is the actual possibility of experiencing, as a reality, what I am now going to write on the blackboard for you. Your experience of winter through the medium of the will can be expressed in these words, quote, O cosmic likenesses wafting toward me from wide widths of space, you seek me out and enter with strength into the thought forces of my head, close quote. These words have no merely abstract meaning. If you can feel your own will united with nature, you will also feel when winter comes as though your own experiences, handed over to nature, were being brought to you from the expanses of space. And in the wave-like flow movement indicated here, quote, O cosmic likenesses, wafting toward me from wide widths of space, you seek me out, and enter with strength into the thought forces of my head, close quote, you can be aware of your own experiences, which had already passed over into nature. This is how winter will feels. But you can also feel the summer will, which bears your thoughts out into the cosmos, quote, you of my head, the soul forces of forming, you fill my whole body, close quote. Which means that the thoughts, which are at first experienced in the head, pass over into and fill the whole body, but then wing their way forth from it. Quote, then wing your way outward to cosmic expanses, uniting my being with the might of creation. Close quote. These words express the nature of summer will, the will in us that is related to summer. If I feel that I have called up out of my inner being the active memory of something experienced long ago, then the day followed by night brings it back to me again, supplemented by the spatial picture. This corresponds to the stream from east to west. Thus we may say winter will changes in us into summer will into winter will. We are no longer related to the day with its alternating light and darkness, but through our will we are related to the year, and therewith to the stream flowing from west to east, the stream of the first hierarchy, the seraphim, cherubim, and thrones. In our further meetings, we shall see how human beings may be hindered or helped through heredity or adaptation to the external world through this association with the inmost life of nature. For what I have just been telling you refers to the fact that human beings, when hindered as little as possible by Ahrimanic and Luciferic forces, grow in this way, by means of thought forces and will, into the inmost life of nature, and are received by the spirits of time, the spirits of day, and the spirits of the year, third hierarchy, second hierarchy, and first hierarchy. But the Ahrimanic forces manifesting in heredity and the Luciferic forces in adaptation exert very deep influences. This big subject will occupy us next time. Winter will. O cosmic likenesses, wafting toward me from wide widths of space, you seek me out, and enter with strength into the thought forces of my head. Summer will. You of my head, the soul forces are forming. You fill my whole body. Then wing your way outward to cosmic expanses, uniting my being with the might of creation. That's the end of Lecture 3.